I first thought about flying in charity when I flew in Mexico and Colombia. When coming into land in Valle de Bravo, there'd be a dust cloud approaching you, and it turned out to be a group of cute kids, begging you to choose them to pack your glider. The first day I agreed, but I felt bad about all the kids I hadn't picked. It was like picking teams at school. Someone always has to be last to be the one that's picked. I had a discussion with other Western visiting pilots about this in the evening, and one of them told me not to give money to packing kids. They can become a major breadwinner in their family and may be taken out of school to work this way to support their families. And then what happens? One day these little cute kids are grown adults with no schooling. So have I inadvertently helped deprive these locals of a real opportunity for the future? Am I doing more harm than good? The rest of my trip, I carried sweets for the groups of kids that would inevitably come and see us land, whether they wanted to pack for us or not. I did my own packing and congratulated myself on being part of the solution, not part of the long-term problem. More about how misguided and inflexible I was in those thoughts a bit later on. We fly in lots of beautiful and amazing places. We travel to cheap and impoverished places like Nepal, India, Pakistan, Africa, South and Central America, with our fancy and very expensive equipment. Most of us have experienced the hospitality of strangers when landing out. I've often said that it's impossible to hitchhike in Colombia. You don't get the chance to get your thumb out before a local person has stopped and offered you a lift. I've been fed and watered when landing out, given information and assistance. Yeah, I bring my tourist pound or dollar to the country, but is that really helping the people in those communities? Is there more that I can do to engage better with the locals? Well, luckily there are organisations of and for pilots who want to make that difference. The Cloud-Based Foundation was set up a few years ago as a result of pilots wanting to make a difference. They now have a multitude of projects in countries like Ecuador, Honduras, Haiti, Malawi, Ghana, Nepal, and many more. They also help communities at home in the USA, for example, by helping local young people or using free flight to heal the community after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. On their website, they explain their goal to work to equip free flight pilots with best practices, support and training, to effectively engage with their community and accomplish their altruistic goals through singular events or long-term projects. Through Cloud-Based Foundation projects, pilots integrate into communities in which they fly to develop strong relationships and stay connected to the local need. Communities are able to partner with project leaders to solve challenges and maximise opportunities within their own communities. Pilots and supporters donate resources, time, and talent to generously impact the communities in which they fly in locations across the world. Sustainable development and support is the key. In this podcast, I speak to Isabella Messenger, who's a board member of the Cloud-Based Foundation and a member of staff at Karma Flights, which is a non-governmental organisation, or NGO, in Nepal. She's an accomplished competition acro and tandem pilot, and she shares her time between her native Germany, the USA and Nepal. Karma Flights was working for improved educational access for Nepali children when the devastating earthquake hit in April 2015. The earthquake killed more than 8,000 people and injured more than 21,000. It was the worst natural disaster to strike Nepal since 1934. Karma Flights sprang into action and provided essential aid and support for devastated communities. The free flight community rallied around the organisation and provided much needed funding for their work. I began my discussion with Bella by talking about my misguided perceptions of charity and giving to children, particularly child packers, and she opened my eyes to a much wider perspective than my limited Western view had allowed for. What do you think about this notion of pilots giving money to children to pack, and do you think that's a sustainable way of providing help in the communities we fly in?
Well, these issues are never black and white, like everything else in life. You know, they're a little bit more complex than it initially appears. So our first knee-jerk reaction, and the same for me when I moved to Nepal, was don't employ children. And, you know, we worked on this topic. We went back and forth on it for years. I can't comment not knowing the culture and specifics of the situation in Mexico, but I can tell you that in Nepal, you know, and this is coming from someone, our whole NGO is based around education. It's what we do. We build schools, we give kids scholarships. We believe very strongly that education is the answer for most children. However, in the case of the packing boys, it's a very well-paid job. And so a lot of these kids, they also, their English skills were very strong. Their understanding of Western culture and tourism was very strong. Tourism is one of the backbones of the income or economics of Nepal. So basically, they had all these really valuable life skills that they were developing through their working relationship, as you know, from a young age up, that in the end, for a lot of them, I would say in Nepal, about 80% of the kids that start out as packing kids end up in a really good place economically when they get a bit older, because they often get sponsored with equipment, they get trained up. Their ground handling skills are amazing, so they become really good tandem pilots. Also, their skills in working with Westerners and knowing how to interact with Westerners is really good. So in the end, actually, we learned that our ideology of, you know, education equals good all the time, you have to be flexible with these things, and you have to really not just put your own ideology into the mix every time in a very non-flexible mindset, but you have to look at really what actually works best for these kids and for the families in the long run. So I would say in terms of giving out handouts, that's pretty much a no-go everywhere in the world. If you just hand kids money, they're not really gaining anything from that. And if anything, it creates a really poor long-term, you know, they do age out of that. Little cute beggar kids age out of that quite quickly. However, if children are learning a life skill, and it's, you know, in a place like Nepal, about 80% of the population is either underemployed or unemployed, it's something really valuable that the kids are gaining. So, you know, you have to kind of be judicious in these things. And really, I think what I always recommend to people is when they're traveling, speak to local trusted partners. You know, talk to the lead pilots in the community, people that seem to be really switched on, and you know, get their opinion. They're usually the best source. Don't talk to other Westerners. Don't talk to other tourists. But do talk to some local Nepalese or local Mexicans and ask for their opinion, and then you get a bit more of a balanced approach.
I think that's really good advice. So in order to actually have a more sustainable impact in various communities, the Cloud-Based Foundation and Karma Flights was started. Can you give me a bit about the history of the two organizations?
So Karma Flights is a program of the Cloud-Based Foundation. The Cloud-Based Foundation is a 501c3 registered organization in the U.S. And basically what that translates to is tax donation. All the donations that you make to Karma Flights through Cloud-Based Foundation are tax deductible. So that's really important for a lot of people. Also, they're kind of our fiduciary arm in the sense that they make sure that we're transparent. They give us a lot of advice from their board. They have a lot of really experienced people in their board of advisors that have been working in the humanitarian world for a long time. So they're really great kind of brainstorming for us, a small local partner, which is Karma Flights. Karma Flights is a fully Nepali, other than myself, run a local NGO based out of Pokhara, Nepal. And it was actually started by an amazing gentleman by the name of Prem Bahadur Kunwar, Matt Cohn, who's a pilot out of Seattle, and later myself. The three of us noticed that a lot of pilots, some of the most incredible experiences that we have in our lives are, of course, through flying. So you land out, sometimes you don't even remember the flight, but you remember the people that you met at the landing, the most incredible people that were so hospitable, welcomed you into their homes, wanted to feed you, didn't want to let you get going again, took you to the highway or to the local road, make sure you got on the bus safely. These incredible interactions that you have with people that make you want to give back in a way. They've given you so much. You've enjoyed the country where you've been able to, you know, travel in 3D through the sky and land and have these life-edifying experiences. So we thought, how can we do something to show our appreciation? And that was basically the spirit of how Karma Flights got started. The national director of Karma Flights, who I just mentioned, Prem, his sister unfortunately committed suicide in a very unfortunately common situation in Nepal, which is that young girls often get pressured into marriage. They don't often have a lot of ability to choose for themselves in terms of their life goals or life path. And so she didn't see really a way out, and chose to take her life. And Prem, obviously his whole family was really rocked by that situation. And he said, I want to ensure that as many girls as we can help not have to have that situation happen in their life as possible. That's what his new life goal was. So that was the other side, how our Nepali partner got involved. And we went from there. We just started a small scholarship program primarily for girls. Prem was a former school teacher, so he was really bedded in with the school program in Nepal. And he would basically canvass around in the villages and listen and hear about stories of young girls who were highly scholastic, highly motivated, but had not been able to continue their education. And those girls were chosen for long-term scholarship.
And so how does it work in practice then with getting your funding?
Well, prior to the earthquake for us in Nepal was kind of a life-changing event for everyone. So there's kind of before earthquake and after earthquake. Before the earthquake, we had some small donors, mostly very grassroots people, pilots that would come through. Also, pilots could fly. They were Karma Flights pilots that would do tandems with friends or associates, didn't want to charge them for the tandems, but requested that instead of that, you just make a donation to Karma Flights. So we had that income stream going. We also had reached a point of almost self-sustainability internally in Nepal by partnering with, there's a huge tandem operation in Nepal for anyone that hasn't flown there. There's now about 60 tandem companies operational. It's kind of a burgeoning industry, to say the least. But a few of those companies had partnered with us prior to the earthquake, and had each of the pilots in the company had promised to donate one flight per month from their commercial activity, and the companies would match that. So basically all of that income stream was helping us to fund our local projects.
That was pre-earthquake, and then the earthquake struck and you went into overdrive. And I was watching you on Facebook, and what you were doing was just unbelievably impressive. So can you tell us a bit about your work and what happened, and basically tell me the story of what happened?
We were in Pokhara the day of the first earthquake, and it was a Saturday. It was midday. It was nice weather, and that turned out to all be very, very good, actually, because it meant that most people were out of their homes. And thankfully, Saturday is the only day that the kids have off school. The earthquake did happen on a Saturday, on a sunny day, thank goodness, because about 7,000 schools collapsed in the first earthquake. And if those schools had all been obviously full of kids, would have been a significantly higher rate of death. So as it was, we were in Pokhara. The earthquake was not very strong there. Everybody ran out of their homes, but it was not, we just thought it was a very strong tremor, stronger than anything I'd ever felt before, but nothing to really raise too many alarm bells. But within about a minute, and this is when you realize how interconnected we all are on this little planet these days, I started to get SMSs, texts, social media pings mostly from Europe. It was a bit early in the States, but mostly from friends in Europe that said, oh, we heard there was this huge earthquake in Nepal. So strangely enough, I actually heard about it through friends in Europe, how devastating it was, before I even knew internally in Nepal. Which is quite interesting. And social media continued to play such an incredible role for us in terms of getting the message out, telling people what was happening. So in that first day, basically, the community of pilots and friends just gathered together kind of informally, and we discussed what should we do? What are we able to do? What makes the most sense? Of course, there was a lot of backlash from people saying, don't go out, you're just going to create more victims. And we listened to that very strong. We thought, well, maybe that's the case, and help is on the way, stay put, and don't create any potential larger problems by putting yourself in harm's way. Sounded like good advice. So fortunately, however, we had a guy, we'll call him Calamity Tim, because he's the luckiest unlucky person I've ever met. He's always in places with disasters, poor guy. He was in tsunami time, he was in Thailand, he was in Japan at this huge time of the earthquake there. So he'd kind of lived through a number of these, and he said, and I'll never forget it, he said it just completely deadpan to all of us. He said, help is not on the way. No one will be there. And we said, Tim, how can that be? He says, they will be coming, but they'll be sitting in Kathmandu, They'll be tied up with bureaucracy. Nepal is a very bureaucratic country. And he says they'll be tied up with red tape, and it's, you know, it's really bad. Unfortunately, the weather shifted. It got really cold that night. It was pouring rain. He said people will be sitting out, especially at the higher altitudes. They will be sitting out with no shelter, aftershocks happening constantly, in terror, no food, and nobody will be there. So that was enough for us to hear to think, okay, let's head out. We've got the jeeps because we're paragliding companies, so we have jeeps. We've got, you know, knowledge of how to work and move in terrain, in mountains. You know, we've done that enough as pilots, landed out in these places. We have good chain of command. We know how to use two-way radios. We've got all the tents, the equipment. You know, we basically have enough to go out and at least be self-sustainable, not create a burden on these communities, and be able to load up, take as much out with us as we can. Fortunately, because Pokhara is a tourist town, there were doctors that were tourists that were around, and one of them was a newly minted guy named Pedro, an absolutely wonderful human being who really got thrown in the deep end. He said, yep, sign me up, I'll come with, and we loaded up one jeep with just medicinal supplies and about three others with tarps for shelter and tents and food and some basic supplies. And we thought, okay, you know, we'll head out, we'll get as far as we can get, and we'll see what we can do. We drove out the next day. Again, it was terrible weather, which in Nepal translates to absolutely unbelievable road conditions. We had about three accidents on the way out, you know, just trying to slog through knee-deep mud. And it took us many hours to actually get out to the epicenter area. By that time, it was dark and pouring rain, and we started to see people kind of being carried on makeshift stretchers out to the road. And there was, as Tim had predicted, nobody there. We were the only ones, which was a very eerie feeling and a great sense of responsibility, of course. And so it was, you know, obviously quite stressful for our group. But we set up tents at the end of the road where the village had just collapsed across the road. We could go no further. And there was thankfully a big empty field there where we set up tents. And by the next morning, people just started to stream down from all the villages. You know, news travels in a very kind of village-to-village quick way. So we had hundreds of people streaming down and asking for, you know, just the basics for food and, you know, a tarp to put over their heads to stay dry. And then there were lots of young men streaming up the road as well, trying to get to their villages. Most young men live in Kathmandu or some other bigger cities to try and work, because they can't have work in the villages. So they started to walk back to try and find out what had happened to their families, and we were able to give them like small provisions, you know, a bag of rice and a tarp and something at least, so that when they got back they could start to set up some shelter. And you know, we had met a lot of medical cases come streaming in as well. Most of them, thankfully, in the first day, there were a lot of airlifts had gone on from the army, which was great. So a lot of the critical cases had been airlifted out. But there were hundreds of people that, you know, needed tetanus shots, had arms broken, legs broken, head injuries, you know, things that if they weren't treated could develop into more serious cases. And we ended up just staying out there for about, well, for 56 days continuously. And the most amazing thing is, and this was so incredibly heartwarming, was to see how our community banded together. It was amazing. Every night at the end of, you know, a 12 or 14 or 16 hour day, I would switch on my phone and hundreds of notices would pour in. Hundreds of people from our free flight community around the world that were saying, how can we help? What can we do? Sending PayPal donations, hundreds of them. And it was so energizing for us as a team out there to know that our community in these times when we're really in distress actually functions as a community. So that was incredible and kept us really strong. We couldn't have stayed out without that, obviously, because we wouldn't have had the funding. Our team that had stayed back in Pokhara set up a logistics hub basically overnight. They were incredible, you know, and they would do the buying of supplies, send out new medical supplies and truckloads of supplies every day. So basically they just started pumping stuff out to us and we would do the distributions in the field. And, you know, we kept saying, we'll keep this up until a better organized organization comes along. And we kept thinking that'll be tomorrow for sure. It's been 2 weeks now for sure. You know, the UN's going to roll in. But what we learned is these organizations are fantastic once they get up and running, but they're giants, they're behemoths. So it takes them weeks to get operational. And in those weeks, people really, really suffer. You know, that's when they're in shock and they have a really hard time, of course, with wrapping their heads around that their entire village has just disappeared. So it was a real privilege, an absolute privilege to be able to be there at that time and to see really what true humanity is. You know, the people that came out and helped, they did it from the goodness of their hearts. They did not expect anything back from it. They just really were out there to try and help their fellow man. And the Nepali people are the most, even, you know, we would go out into some of these villages in the early days and somebody would be sitting on their roof, which is just their whole home had pancaked underneath them. But their first question is always, how are you? Can we give you something? Can we get you a cup of tea? You know, and then they'd say, oh, sorry, we can't actually prepare tea. We don't have, we've lost our kitchen. They never lost their sense of hospitality, even when they lost everything. They still greeted you with a smile, a namaste, and how are you? And that was remarkable. Just talking through it again, it was quite traumatic for us. And we cannot complain because, you know, we had the safety net always to go back to. Whereas you're working with people that have lost everything. So you feel really kind of silly, you know, saying that you felt a little traumatized by the experience. But, you know, it was really hard to see how these poor people were suffering so much.
When you were talking, I was thinking, if it was me, I would have completely freaked out with all the broken legs and broken arms and seeing all the injured people. And
you wouldn't have, Judith. You know, I would have thought that about myself as well. But once you're there, you just go into the work mode. You know, it's the same as when you're flying or doing anything else that requires all your concentration. And that's the other thing to, you know, I can't stress that enough when I talk to people. Just don't let fear hold you back, because you can be a much different person in that situation than you ever anticipated. You rise to the occasion because you have to, you know, and you recognize that your fears or concerns are of zero consequence.
You know, I can actually rise to the occasion. I just...
Absolutely.
Sitting in my sitting room, I think I can. But when it's actually... when I'm there, I'm absolutely fine. No, but like you say... Yeah, I can rise to the occasion, and I'm sure most, you know, a lot of other people can as well. But I really like the fact that you recognised the skills that you had anyway, you know, that you're all outdoor types, you're all fit, you've got jeeps, you've got radios, you know, you were in an ideal position to make a big difference. And the fact
That's
that you
right.
grasped that metal is really, you know, amazing.
I think we didn't actually realise that, because you don't realise how many skills you pick up as a paragliding pilot. You kind of just take it for granted because you're around so many people with the same skill sets that you just kind of think, okay, well, that's normal. But you're right. Once we got out there, we realized, oh, actually everybody in our team has at least rudimentary wilderness first aid training. We've all experienced, you know, accidents and incidents that require this sort of medical treatment. And so we actually knew... And we know how to use GPSs and send GPS waypoints and things, like even for, you know, calling in helis for the medical rescues. Actually, the Indian Army pilots, they were so thankful. When they landed, they ran over to us and they said, which organization are you? You guys know how to send us lat long, UTM, you know, degrees, minutes, seconds. You set up a windsock. You marked off the area. They're like, this is incredible. And they gave us their private WhatsApp numbers to call them anytime we had a medical emergency that needed a pickup, because they were, you know, just thankful that we knew how to work in an aviation environment. And so we thought, oh, okay. We thought that was kind of common knowledge, but of course it isn't. So yeah, paragliding pilots, I think, are pretty uniquely positioned. And obviously all free flight pilots are uniquely positioned to help in an emergency situation because of, yeah, just the logistics stuff they have, the jeeps and also the skill set.
Well, even just driving a jeep in that kind of crazy exactly. terrain is a massive skill.
Exactly. And things like situational awareness when you're out in the mountains, you know, that's another thing we kind of took for granted. But because there were so many aftershocks, it was incredibly unstable, you know, for the weeks following the earthquake. And so there were lots and lots of landslides. So our field teams that were going out from the main camp into all the local villages every day, had to be incredibly situationally aware all the time, you know, not to put themselves in a position of danger. And yeah, that's again something if you're just really used to being in a mountainous environment and kind of, you know, getting yourself retrieved and getting out of weird places. You're used to landing out not on a trekking trail, but in some, you know, weird place that you've managed to stick yourself. So all that history and all that experience really, really became quite significant.
So what's happening now with the organization?
So it's been a tough year for Nepal. You know, basically all the promises made by the government have not come to fruition, which is not unexpected, but of course quite disappointing. You know, there's about $4.5 billion of aid that poured into Nepal from foreign donors, and it would have been even a higher number if the prime minister had not announced suddenly one day very publicly, all donations from foreign donors will now be going through my personal bank account. He even published his personal bank account details in the Kathmandu Post. So, of course, the minute that happened, the international donors threw up their hands and said, okay, you know, obviously the corruption is so endemic, you know, that we can't support them. So it's been really, you know, the recovery of Nepal has been very, very reliant on grassroots organizations and some of the more effective larger INGOs. There was also, unfortunately, a huge embargo with India, which cut off fuel supply to Nepal for about 6 months, which some say is even worse in terms of its impact on the average Nepali than the original earthquake, which I would have to agree, because basically it dried up all of the NGO's ability to get goods and services out into the field because no one had petrol. No one could put fuel into their helicopters or trucks or cars to get goods and materials out to Nepal. So that was a really, really tough time. During that time, we actually tried to do as much as possible through use of pack animals. Mules and yaks are really a popular way, always have been, in Nepal to get goods out to people. So we were able to still continue our work even during that time. But now, thankfully, that's been ameliorated, and you know, there's kind of a normal flow of goods across the border with India again. So what we started to do now is long-term school reconstruction projects. What we learned is that even if there's one building in a village or a village development community that's standing, it means that the community has some security and an ability to kind of quickly pull themselves back up from their bootstraps if another earthquake occurs, which it will, because if you look at the Himalayas, it's an incredibly geologically active area. There's usually a big earthquake every, you know, 80 years at the furthest. Mm-hmm. So we're building schools because we know that, you know, if at least that one earthquake-resistant building is standing, communities will have a safe shelter. And in the meanwhile, the kids really need to get back to school. Education is, it's hard to overemphasize how important education is to Nepali villagers, actually. Before, you know, we would go into the villages and say, okay, what do you need most? And they would say, don't worry, we can live in these temporary tent homes, but we need our kids to get back to school. So please build the school before you start building our homes. You know, it's that important to them. So we're building schools. We're selecting kids for long-term scholarships because that's really the way to bring safety to a community. If kids are educated, they can advocate for themselves. They can learn about what's available to them. They can go to Kathmandu and sign up for a passport or a citizenship card, which gives them some rights, voting rights, for example. They can learn about health issues. You know, all of those things come as a result of being at least, at the very least, literate. And we've started by selecting 100 kids that had lost a close family member in the earthquake. And those kids we've committed to for a minimum of 3 years. So basically all of their living expenses are paid for 3 years. And then after that, we'll review, and if they meet certain scholastic requirements, we'll continue to sponsor them as far as they want to go through to university level if they qualify.
Other than actually just donating to you, is there anything else that pilots can do to make a difference in the communities they fly in, where they go on holiday?
You know, I would say don't ever underestimate your own power as an individual for change. You know, this is what I think we've all, as a little tiny grassroots organization, have learned through this process. Just by putting ourselves out there, and doing the best we could, you know, and not being intimidated by lack of experience or training, but still, of course, being safety conscious and being conscientious about what we're doing, you can affect tremendous change in the quality of people's lives, you know. And what more powerful thing can you do in this life? You know, we're often out there risking our lives for extra WPRS points or GoPro footage, and that's fun and it's great and there's nothing wrong with that. But at the end of the day, that's not the sort of stuff that's going to edify you as you go to the grave. And so, you know, if you get a niggling feeling when you're in an area and think, oh, I could do something here to maybe help this community, or if you make a connection with somebody in an area that you fly, why not, you know, explore it and see if even one individual's life can be helped by your activity or by your small donation or by volunteering at a school, or just, you know, keep your eyes peeled and see what comes across your path. The universe does provide you with lots of opportunities if you're willing to follow them. So meet a special kid when you're, you know, traveling or staying in a community. Check in with local trusted people and in the flying community and see if it's appropriate to help in that way. And absolutely, for sure, you will get back 1,000 times what you give. In terms of a call to action that could be really useful, is we are still looking for kind of specialists, anybody that has a background in especially earthquake-proof engineering, or anybody that's an expert in trail building or a certified teacher, or if you have medical training. All those people with special skill sets can still be fantastic volunteers in Nepal. We don't take normal tourists out in the field because that's not really the best use of their time. But if you have, you know, a couple of weeks free and you're thinking about traveling to Nepal and you want to just have an amazing, you know, not just your average paragliding trip, but also a mix of humanitarian work and paragliding, we'd love to hear from you. And I again want to say thank you so much to our free flight community around the world. We cannot say how grateful we were every day checking in. Thankfully, we were able to connect still on our phones, and all the calls and donations and offers of support really, you know, made me recognize what an incredible community we have. And it's great to know that that's out there and available for the next emergency, wherever it happens in the world. If you let pilots know about it, they will jump in the fray and help.
You've certainly inspired thousands, you know, to roll up their sleeves and jump in next time something big happens, or if they can make a difference. You know, you had so many followers during that time, those 56 days that you're up that mountain, and I think people were just really like, wow, you know, felt really that you were kind of our representative in the field, you know, that we all had a little bit of a kind of stake in the success of it, and just great to see that somebody was doing stuff very practically to help people.
Well, thank you very much. And I think, you know, people love Nepal. And yeah, of course, the number one way that people can help, you know, is to come and visit, just be a tourist, you know, help to build the country back up from a very sustainable standpoint, which is tourism. You know, just come over and spend your tourist dollars, stay in homestays, go trekking, go flying. Nepal is very much open for business. You know, the areas that were destroyed by the earthquake are not our typical flying sites. So Pokhara was very unaffected. Sirkot, where Babu's place is, Babu who flew off Everest, obviously, everybody knows him. He's got a beautiful site open south of Pokhara that's totally unaffected. So there's lots of great, great reasons to come and visit Nepal now if you really want to help.
Thank you, Bella, for telling me your story and for shedding light on such an important issue. Karma Flights and the Cloud Based Foundation do amazing work. And if you would like to support them, please make a donation at www.thecloudbasefoundation.org or www.karmaflights.org. But as Bella said, you can make a difference in all sorts of ways. Talk to the locals and see what you can do. Eat and stay local, use local guides. And if you don't travel much, there are plenty of things you can do at home. Give a talk at your local school to inspire kids about your flying adventures. We usually fly in rural places, so why not ask if you can support a local elderly person by bringing them their shopping when you're travelling to that isolated takeoff? We're a well-resourced and resourceful community, As ambassadors for our sport, we have and continue to make a positive impact. So thanks to everyone who does their bit, small or large. If you'd like to listen to other paragliding podcasts, you can do so by going to the podcast page at www.theparaglider.com. If you've enjoyed the webcasts, podcasts and articles on the Paraglider website, please consider making a donation. You can see the donate button on the index page of theparaglider.com or in any of the podcast pages. Many thanks.